Hey, hey, what's up, folks? Oh, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast. I'm Michael Steele, your humble host. You can find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you like to get your podcast thing on. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Now, I went powerhouse this week because there's just the storylines are just too juicy. So I had to get this brother on the hook because he, of a lot of journalists out there, has had his finger on this pulse, certainly the Russia storyline, for well over 2 years now. He's the author of the bestseller, co-author with Michael Isikoff, entitled Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War in America and the Election of Donald Trump. He is the chief and on-air analyst for MSNBC. He is the one and only Mother Jones Bureau Chief, David Korn. Welcome to the podcast,
hey.
Man. Good to have you.
Good to be with you. And I feel like I should be jumping in the ring with the boxing gloves. You know, he is the welterweight champion.
There he
1957.
Is. He's bringing it live. He's bringing it live. Now, also joining us in the ring is the one and only Liz Copeland. I've known Liz a long time. She's a great, great lady, GOP strategist and founder of the Urban Conservative Project, which we want to talk a little bit about that and what that means, particularly in this particular climate. Liz, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast.
Thanks for having me. And, you know, David, this is more like MMA. I punch and kick, so make sure you know you're ready.
Oh, no.
You're ready for this fight. I'm just joking. A little bit.
This is going to be good. This is what we like. This is how we like to bring it. So sexual assault accusations have rocked the Kavanaugh hearing. Where the hell did this come from? This is like September. Why didn't we know about this in July? Why didn't we? David, come on, man. What's going on here?
It had nothing to do with me. If I had found this out, I would have reported it. I mean, these cases are really difficult. And believe me, I've had similar experiences when someone comes forward or contacts you and has a story, an important story, an important allegation. And then they say, but I can't go public. You can't quote me. You can't use it. With my name, I just want you to know this. And that's not an uncommon approach when people have what they think are traumatic stories of things that could affect them. So Dr. Ford, the woman in question here, you know, told Dianne Feinstein's staff or sent a letter saying, I have this story to tell, but I don't want to tell it publicly. Now, the reason you do this, people say, well, why would you do it that way? Is because they really want people to, you know, the investigators to look to see if they can find other instances or, you know, if there's anything else similar out there, not necessarily make a big deal of my story. So she told Dianne Feinstein's office that she had to be confidential. So she did, you know, abided by that. And
until they leaked it.
Well, I don't think she leaked it, but I think other Democrats who heard about it, finally heard about it, they did leak it. So, you know, what do you do? I mean, they leaked it. They thought it should be out there. And so they violated an agreement that they didn't really weren't a party to. And it comes out. You know, it's unfortunate it didn't come out earlier, but that's in part how these things happen. I think when Anita Hill first went to the committee back in the early 90s, she didn't want to be named and come out public. And that story leaked too, and then she, I think, became a champion.
Yeah, I get that, but I certainly appreciate the point you make about the journalist. I've been one of those individuals who have had conversation with journalists and said, look, let me just give you this background initially. Nothing public, et cetera, et cetera. Don't want my name near it for the time being or whatever. I get that. But this is different, Liz. This is, you're talking about the committee that's technically investigating, but certainly doing the advise and consent on the nominee of the president to the Supreme Court. Wouldn't you think
right.
that these guys would just, you know, at least, okay, fine. We don't have to have a public display, but we need to get an investigation. Take this to the chairman of the committee and say, this is what's come in the door. we need to investigate this. Then if Grassley, who's the chairman, starts, you know, showing his ass and not really wanting to cooperate, then you may follow another political strategy. But to sit on this for almost 3 months and then drop it literally a week before the vote?
Yeah, when I look at this, this is a situation I see politics, gender, and race, especially when we're comparing this situation with the set of facts that we know and the Anita Hill situation. And it, you know, as a Republican and as a woman, all of this bothers me. I do think it was politicized that they leaked it, because after the hearings, Kavanaugh basically came out and it looked like he was going to have smooth sailing, you know, coming out of the committee and then being, you know, voted into his the position on the Supreme Court. But if you look at the timeline, Justice Kennedy, he said he was going to retire on June 27th. On July 9th is when the president introduced Kavanaugh. His name wasn't on that original list of 20
right,
or 24
right.
people that the president had. So in all fairness, the accuser at that time, she didn't know who was going to be on. She didn't know that Kavanaugh was going to be the nominee, Donald Trump's nomination for the Supreme Court
right.
until July 9th. So while she had that information, Feinstein had that information, the pieces of the puzzle weren't, you know, coming together until July 9th. Now, you fast forward until what, last week is when we first heard about it. And if I recall correctly, when Anita Hill was forced into the limelight, the FBI came to her office. She didn't initiate. She didn't ask for the FBI to come. But they came to her office, pulled her out, and said, we are investigating this claim of sexual harassment as a part of the investigation for the fitness, you know, and character for Clarence Thomas. So now we have this accuser saying, I'm not going to tell my side of the story. I'm not going to participate in a public hearing unless we have an FBI investigation, and really forcing the administration to make a stand. You know, President Trump won more white women than Hillary Clinton did. And so I think she's trying to force the issue to see where he stands on this. And they can do an FBI investigation if they want to. It only took them 3 days with Anita Hill. We got enough time between, you know, 2 days ago and Monday's hearing. But unfortunately, I'm sitting back thinking, as a woman, you know, this is you don't want to see this woman being vilified. You know, they victimize, you know, they blame the victim during the Anita Hill process. Even Joe Biden said, I feel bad at the questioning, the line of question that came from the senators during that public hearing with Anita Hill. We don't want to see that again.
But
she shouldn't have to go through that.
But there is no easy.
But I hear a lot of conflict in Liz's remarks, coming as a, you know, person who cares about racial justice, gender justice, and who is also a Republican. To me, that may be a contradiction, but we'll talk about that another day. And I think the way it came out may not have been the best way, but, you know, listen, at the same time, they've been rushing this this nomination through. We know why. They have not provided all the emails and material from when he served previously, and they've sat on that. So, you know, listen, talking about the timing is really secondary now to the issue before us. You can't always choose how these things emerge. But this is how this one came out. Republicans would have been very happy if this hadn't come out, if it stayed confidential. And now she's asking for an investigation, which really wouldn't take too long. There aren't too many people to talk to, the way that there was an Anita Hill investigation, before she goes up before a committee on which there are members who have already basically denigrated her. You know, a Hatch is out there basically saying she's a liar.
Yeah, and
you can't do that.
You can't do that. And but here's, I think, Liz, you raise, and David, I'd love to get your thoughts on this piece as well, because as we saw from Anita Hill, and as we will see here, if there is a public hearing, there is no easy way to ask questions related to sexual harassment. I mean, have you ever spent time in a courtroom and watch a prosecutor
right.
or a defense attorney deal with the victim and the accuser and the accused rather in that setting? There is no easy way to do it. What colors this and what makes this so much more unfortunate is a number of things. One, even after since the Anita Hill hearings, there has been no effort made by members of the United States Senate or the House to effectively put in place the types of policies and procedures that would then touch on the types of decorum and questions that would be asked in that setting should that come up again. They always treat these things as a one-off. I always see them as a precursor of the future because you're not going to get away from it. And two, to the point you made, David, you've got Republicans who've already tipped their hand when Orrin Hatch makes that, I think, fatal and unfortunate comment about Ms. Dr. Ford basically being, you know, out of her mind. She doesn't know what she's talking about. I think the woman would know, even regardless of what state she's in, at some point that she had been violated, right? The body kind of tells you if that happened, you know. And,
right.
And to dismiss that, I think, puts the entire Senate committee in a hot seat that's made even hotter by the comments like that.
Right. I think for me, the committee has to determine the fitness and character of the nominee. And that's a very subjective standard. I mean, yes, we have these baseline standards in our society, but, you know, what one could deem fit, another could potentially deem unfit. Then you have all, it was 13 members on the Republican side are just men who are going to be sitting there potentially judging the statements of what I would consider a credible accuser. And so then you have to make a determination. I guess the presenting question really is one allegation without substantiated evidence or, you know, another person corroborating her statements, is that enough for the Republicans to vote this nominee down? And I think that that's a very interesting question. And I think it speaks to our culture, our society. And as a woman, I'm looking at this and thinking about all these other cases where women have such a high bar to pass through, a high standard, just to get some semblance of justice because there wasn't another witness. And it's hard for me to watch this. And if you think about the credibility of Dr. Ford, you know, she was traumatized from this event and spoke with a therapist. So that's like, you know, I don't think we're going to bring the therapist into a public hearing. But, you know, this is her evidence that she's going to present. And, you know, the committee should take this evidence. Her testimony is evidence. The second thing, there is at least one other graduate who has been on the record, I believe in the Washington Post, Ms. King, stating she's almost corroborating, it's hearsay, but still, you know, this is an administrative hearing, it's not a court of law, you know, it's not a criminal standard. She heard about the incident. And then the third part, there's the Brett O'Kavanaugh that's referenced in Mr. Judge's book, who passed out drinking, which kind of leads one to believe it's at a very high standard. There's a preponderance of evidence that it is highly likely that Kavanaugh committed this act. And well, so I, as a senator, you got to take all of that into consideration to determine, you know, that it's possible and maybe we shouldn't vote this person in. And the last thing I'm going to say on that is that they have other conservative jurist nominees. I mean, you know, potential nominees. They want to get somebody to go in there, and I'm exaggerating for effect, to just dismantle Roe v. Wade, and I'm not saying that they do. They can find somebody else to do that. I think it's a bad decision.
Well,
to move
on that, on that point, I will say this. Much to, I think, the ultimate chagrin of my friend David Corn and a number of his friends on the left, I don't think that is part of the agenda for this judge, knowing him as I do. I think he recognizes, despite what people have said his public statements or writings have been, I think he would play more of a centrist role on this court, which is why no one paid attention to this. Maybe you did, Liz, in the conservative corner. There are a lot of conservatives who are put out about his nomination. There were a lot of complaints about elevating him to the bench because, as you rightly noted at one point in our conversation, he was not on the original list. He was added, and he was added because there is this feeling among some that the quote establishment really wanted to get in some form of play. So he's largely conservative on a lot of the big things that folks would be happy with, But on some of these other questions, as we saw with Justice Roberts, no one thought going into Justice Roberts would be not once but twice the anchor that would uphold the Affordable Care Act. I bet that this is where you also see a space for someone like Judge Kavanaugh going forward, which is why there was so much rancor among the rank and file among conservatives. But even having said all of that, folks, you know, you still are faced with the fact that right now Republicans want to get past this. You've got strategists as well as members outright saying they're very confident about this vote that's going to take place on the judge. I don't think, you know, they're going to be much swayed off of not holding this hearing, whether she's there or not. I think they're going to, you know, at least take Kavanaugh's testimony, afford her every opportunity. I think, David, that if she showed up, that would be the worst thing for Republicans. So they're kind of hoping right. She doesn't come to this hearing on Monday.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this thing is so fraught, right? Because it, you know, involves gender politics, partisan politics,
right.
A Supreme Court pick that is in a highly partisan environment after with the what I call the Merrick Garland disaster, which I think really upended norms and was an attack on the way things should work in Washington. So there's a whole swirling vortex in which this particular episode appears. And we do know that the old white guys, and I'm an old, kind of getting close to being an old white guy. The old white guys.
You're still looking good, baby. You're still looking good.
Oh, thanks, man. I can see it from here. They, you know, the those guys, you know, have absolutely, they're just completely out of touch with this. They, unlike the Anita Hill days, they at least know that they should be in touch with what's going on, but they just can't really do it. So there is just no telling what's going to happen in the next couple of days about this, whether she will testify or not. She may not testify, and she may appear and do a interview and explain why she, you know, isn't testifying because she doesn't feel she's getting a fair hearing. That might have an impact. And, you know, the Republicans might rush ahead with this, and who knows what Jeff Flake and Susan Collins and others who have, you know, spoken out on this from the Republican side will do. So I think everything still remains up for grabs, which is, you know, kind of par for the course in Trump's Washington, where, you know, you can never bet on chaos, right? Chaos goes in different directions. And that's what we have with this nomination at this point in time. And I'd rather be talking about his jurisprudence. We at Mother Jones published a story that's gotten a lot of attention.
Yep.
About very significant
questions
about his finances. His finances, you know, he had debt that disappeared. He got a membership in a country club that he couldn't afford on his own salary. You know, so there's a lot of things like that are not being resolved. We didn't get all the paperwork that was requested from his days in government. And I, you know, of course, I'd rather be fighting over that than over this. But, you know, this is the way life goes. We don't really have a choice. And a lot, I think, rides on what she decides to do, Dr. Ford. And for her, it's a very personal, you know, decision. Look, she's been getting death threats. She had to move out of her home. That's, you know, for those of us in the public eye, that's often, you know,
right.
Par for the course.
Which is why she didn't want to do this.
You know,
in the
we've
first
all
place.
Gotten. Yeah, yeah, and this is what, and then you get, you know, and I think, you know, we live in Washington. We're all on cable TV, and we all take our punches. You, Michael, you've been denigrated by your peers at the Republican National Committee. I mean, we're used to this, but for someone who's not, to have, you know, a senator out there, you know, denigrating her as Orrin Hatch did, to have Joe DiGiova going on Fox News and saying she's a loon.
Yeah.
She's a loon. I mean, that really, you know, people call you, me, Liz crazy. You know, we deal with it. That's the price of being prominent in public discourse in this country. But for most people, that is really hard to bear.
Yeah.
And so that's what she's going through. So her decision, you know, is based on a lot of things. And there is, you know, at this point, no reason to rush her, but that's what Republicans are trying to do, and make it seem like she, you know, won't stand behind her allegations in their, you know, in their sphere. So we'll see. But God, I mean, this story is going to take three more turns before your next podcast.
Yeah, well, that's very true. And you know, just to just kind of put a little period on what you just said there. I think the final point that you made is the most important, is that these folks who are everyday citizens, you know, who have these experiences and have to deal with them, try to deal with them very privately, because they are, and in many cases and oftentimes, as we know, traumatic. But then to have that splayed across the nation's media outlets and networks and newspapers, and then to have commentators and people who have no clue talking out of their ass about you is the most offensive part. To refer to this woman as a loon, to say she doesn't know what she's doing. People deal with trauma a lot differently. I've mm-hmm. worked with people. I know people who've had very traumatic events occur in their lives, and they deal with it differently. Some people repress it. Other people lash out. Some people try to ignore it. Some people, you know, laugh through it. Everyone's reaction is different. It is clear something happened. To the point mm-hmm. where this woman had to get treatment on it. In a way that, you know, it affected her marriage. It affected her relationship with her family and her friends. So this isn't a one-off. This isn't someone who just made this up because, oh, gee, we're a week away from Kavanaugh becoming Supreme Court Justice. I think I'll just go and say he did these things to me. That's not what this is. And not shame on you, but just shut the hell up, all you folks out there using your prominence to speak out of your ass about something you know jack about. Now, talking about speaking out of your ass, the president went down to North Carolina this week to survey the damage from Hurricane Florence, which 14 people, at least the last reporting I saw, maybe 16 people had lost their lives in this storm. So the loss of one life is devastating for sure, in addition to the property damage and the like. So the president is touring. He does his, you know, we're giving you a lot of help. So he comes across this family, these people, and he asked them, you know, where they lived, and they showed them the house. Well, behind the house, there was this large yacht that had washed ashore and was shipwrecked against the wooden deck of this home, of this man's home, right? And the president looks at the yacht and says, ask the guy, is that your boat? And the owner said, no, that's not my boat. And the president turns to him and goes, well, at least you got a nice boat out of the deal. People.
He's so tone deaf.
People,
wow.
Help me understand, folks, why is this man allowed in public? why?
None of this is surprising. And you say, why does he do this? Well, the guy has, if not one, multiple personality disorders. And it sounds hyperbolic to say that. But he, you know, he always brings everything back to himself. It's about him. He has no ability to empathize, which, you know, some psychologists would say that's one, you know, one of the symptoms of a psychopath, right? And it's just, he just can't get out there and think about the world in terms beyond how things relate to him. So, you know, look at North Korea. It's all about what Kim says to him.
Right.
It's not about what Kim does to his own people. It's not about what the actual policy and Kim, you know, moving ahead with the nuclear program. It's about, oh, Kim treated me well. So he's a great guy, you know, compared to Justin Trudeau, who I think is a snotty-nosed, you know, pisher up in Canada who doesn't like me. Trump, it's all about Trump, and he sees everything in the world. This is what narcissism is. You see everything in the world only as it relates to you, what it means for you, how it reflects you. And if you're that type of person, you don't care about details. You don't care about policy. You don't care about what other people think. And that's a dangerous person to have in the White House and to be in charge of nuclear weapons and everything else.
Oh, it is. And so, Liz, so in the midst of the storm and the ravages thereof and the deaths that occurred, the president, not to be outdone by the reports that had also come out a few days before on the Puerto Rico storm from last year, where the numbers were revised upward to the tune from 16 to 2,975 deaths. The president tweets out 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. When I left the island after the storm had hit, they had anywhere from 6 to 18 deaths. As time went by, the numbers didn't go up that much. Then a long time later, they started to report really large numbers, like 3,000. This was done by the Democrats in order to make me look bad, as bad as possible when I was successfully raising billions of dollars to help rebuild Puerto Rico. First off, you run the friggin' government. You don't raise money. It's not a fundraiser. You don't hold a town hall and invite people to put $10 in the can and pass the hat to help those who've been. You run FEMA, for God's sake. It's in the budget to pay for. So you didn't raise any money, number one. Number two, and I'd love to get your take on this. Mm-hmm. How does conservatives respond to a president who is now saying, well, those 3,000 people didn't die, when clearly someone did, because there are a whole lot of families that are going, my loved one ain't here anymore. So what you got DeSantis, who's the Ron DeSantis, who's the gubernatorial candidate, getting his ass kicked by Mr. Gillum. They're starting off with the crazy comment he made on that was racially insensitive. Now DeSantis is distancing himself from the president's remarks because, hey, guess what? Puerto Ricans vote in Florida. And two, the president now is coming back and saying that basically Mr. DeSantis is dead to us. Where does this go? How do we process this, on the edge of big elections in Florida and elsewhere around the country? How are conservatives looking at this, and how is the public generally reacting to some of this stuff?
Well, I think kind of piggybacking off of what David said, I'm not a clinician. I don't have, all the understanding of the DSM-5 to give a proper diagnosis on Trump's behavior. But I can say that I've cringed several times when I've heard or read his statements or I've seen his behavior. And, related to the hurricane, I think he referred as a warning that the Hurricane Florence was going to be a wet one. I mean, that was his official statement as the president. And David's right.
Rain tends to do that. Right?
Yeah, he lacks the ability, or he has not demonstrated inability to be empathetic, to be, well, clearly not the centered moral compass that this country needs, but he can't even just be the good guy at a bar that's like, wow, I'm sorry to hear about what happened. I don't really know you. And that's a very, very, very low standard, but I think I would get more from somebody at a bar than I would get from our chief, our commander in chief. And, when he threw the paper towels out in Puerto Rico, like it was a game show, or he was the t-shirt guy at a football stadium or something, it was just very weird. And I recall him being accused of not being presidential or not having the capacity to act as a president during the campaign. And he said, he assured us that he would be very presidential. And maybe his definition for presidential is different than, mine, but I would expect for him to not try to, figure out or clarify the number of deaths in Puerto Rico that are directly attributed to the his FEMA's response compared to what can be attributed to potentially, infrastructure or operational gaps in Puerto Rico. And I do recall the number of 16 to 32 or whatever it was that was directly related to the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and the 3,000 that were indirectly related to the response, FEMA's response. It does not matter. We're talking about lives, and the president should, I don't know that he can, he should be solemn when we're talking about casualties, and he should be able to speak to his effort or his value of human life, and he won't do it. I agree with David. It's all about him.
Yeah,
it's always,
well, you can't
always going to be about him. And yeah, go. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say you cannot focus on anything else when you are the center of your own universe, and
right.
You are also the stars in that universe. You are the moon mm-hmm. and the planets that are in that universe. When the universe is you, the idea that there is suffering someplace else, there is joy someplace else, there's something about, you know, what David is going through, what you're going through, Liz, or I'm going through, that may matter, and that as president I can speak to and give comfort to or support or praise, that's just totally foreign to him. And I think to David's point, we kind of know that. Now, we're no longer surprised by that. I think David, what surprises us more and more, and I see it in your writing and the writing of others, beyond the, oh, yeah, this is nothing new, but okay, so just how much further down can we go? How much lower can we go in this spiraling here?
I mean, we know all this. I mean, Bob Woodward put out that book 2 weeks ago. We knew the general thrust of everything that he said. Nothing at all was surprising. But when you see descriptions of Trump in the tank, the big secure conference in the Pentagon, and people, Mattis and Tillerson and the so-called grown-ups are talking to him about policy, and he's really like a child saying, no, 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 I can't hear you. No, it doesn't matter what you say. He goes, I hate the World Trade Organization. They always rule against us. They go, actually, Mr. President, we have the figures here. They rule with us 88.7% of the time. He goes, no, that's not right. You're wrong. I mean, we laugh, but, our capacity
give him a lollipop.
Sustain average. Really? It's like, ah! I mean, that's why the big baby floating over London made sense, because his emotional maturity is that of a toddler. And, we can make jokes about it. You and I, we've been on Bill Maher's show. We get good yucks out of this. But at the same time, we have to sustain our capacity for outrage and realize that this is, I said earlier, a dangerous situation. And it's not, and it's not just Trump. Trump is a symptom. It's the fact that your former party, Michael, your party, Liz, has just totally followed him and accepted this, because they get the nominations like Kavanaugh and the tax cuts out of him, and they don't mind having a really, really bad and dangerous human being in charge of the country and the world. And it's that acceptance institutionally from people leading the grand old party, the party of Lincoln and Eisenhower, that enables him, and that leaves us kind of wondering what's happening here.
Well, give me your soapbox.
Can I get an amen?
Amen. Where's that music? It was that organ. Bring in that organ.
but I wanted to kind of piggyback or combine your second part, I guess the second part of your question, Michael, was, how does this really impact, down ballot races? How does Trump's behavior, influence Republican voters? And what does the establishment do? But I think, the establishment is looking at Trump and they're rolling their eyes. They're speaking in private. Well, we already know that they did. I mean, according to published reports,
right,
people have already, dismissed the president, but they see him as a means to an end. And so they see this president as having the ability and doing pretty well on the ability to decrease regulation to the benefit of corporations, reducing taxes. Unemployment is down. The economy is up. The median household income has risen in the past year and a half, 2 years. And so as you look at what the president says and the policies that he's able to, push forward, candidates running either for statewide office or, during this midterm for Congress, they are running towards President Trump, not away from him. They're running towards him. And even in these primary elections, you can see when President Trump tweets out, I like this person is great, these candidates are able to make it out of the primary pretty with significant numbers. But the question is, are they going to be able to use and leverage the association with the president for the general?
Well,
and
that's
talked about DeSantis in Florida. And
right.
I don't think I so look, in Maryland, Larry Hogan, he's a Republican governor. He's, I think, the most popular governor in the country. I mean, he's running against, he has a challenger who
Ben
is a
Jealous,
part of, I would say, the socialist, you know, Ben Jealous, and Ben Jealous is not faring well in the polls. Stacey Abrams in Georgia, I don't think that Stacey Abrams is going to pull it out. Andrew Gillum, I think he will. I think that DeSantis' association with the president in Florida, especially, as you said, with Puerto Rican voters, or just, you know, voters in general, they are going to see that association and they're going to penalize DeSantis for it.
Well, that's why I still think race is going to play a little bit more of a factor than people really want to deal with or be honest about in Florida, in Georgia, and in other states where African Americans are either running statewide or running for a significant office. I still think the party, not the party, but the country, well, the party too, but the country as a whole, and both parties still have a lot of reconciliation around the question of race. But you raise a question that I want to push on about whether or not these candidates who made it out of their great, you know, sort of in the right corner primary where, you know, independent voters, center right Republicans and others rarely really have a lot of sway. Now walking into a general election with the president of the United States sort of leading, you know, at the tip of that particular electoral spear, running out there trying to now convince these voters who are center right, who are, Democrats who may be less inclined towards the member of their party if they're, you know, a real hard-charging progressive and independent voters, now sitting around feeling like, I don't have any place to go. What do Republicans do with this? The president has made it very clear he wants his wall and he wants it yesterday. So he has tweeted out yet again his desire that he wants the money for border security and the wall in the spending bill that's currently under consideration. And the question he's asking, where will it come from after the midterms? Dems are obstructing law enforcement and border security. Republicans must finally get tough. The bottom line for the president is he is prepared to shut down the government literally 3 weeks, 2 weeks before the general election. What do Republicans do with that, Liz? And then David.
What? I mean, this is ridiculous. What do they do with that?
Yeah.
I think what they should do is not going to be what they ultimately end up doing. I think what they should do is finally draw a line in the sand, have a clear line of demarcation that this is counter every conservative policy principle that we've ever uttered in the past 30 years, and this is not good governing. And what they're going to do is they're going to say that we're going to talk with the president and we're going to, you know, we're going to continue to push this issue along, and they're going to have some, you know, temporary, you know, fix, but they're going to try to kick the can down the road until after the midterm election.
Essentially, that's what Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell have said. They have pressed the president to get him to agree with their plan to, quote, postpone this fight with the Democrats over the wall and all of that, and to go forward and pass as many of the bipartisan bills, spending bills that they have in place right now before Election Day. The president's response to that and those legislative packages, he called them ridiculous. So the president is clearly standing on Mount Shutdown.
It goes back to what we were saying a moment ago. Does Donald Trump care about anything other than himself? Does he care about the Republican Party? I agree with Liz that probably at the end of the day, after much tantruming, that's a word, Trump will agree
to... We can make it a word.
Trump will agree to a postponement, because if there is a shutdown... If there is chaos, I mean, listen, the Republicans control everything. They can try to blame the Democrats, but in, you know, the districts where they're vulnerable, that blame game won't work. It won't, you know, they're in charge, and if they can't make things run, you know, suburban voters, centrist Republican voters, people concerned about Trump's ability and sanity will, you know, make them pay. So if Trump threatens this, it shows he doesn't care about the party, but eventually they'll probably, you know, work out something to get it past the election day. But one of the things that I've been doing recently, since you asked, Michael, is focusing at some of these down ballot races. And I've done a series of stories on one of the vulnerable Republicans, a guy named Dana Rohrabacher, who's down in Orange County, California, who's known as Putin's favorite congressman because he seems to be very pro-Putin, pro-U.S.-Russian relations. But what I found, and this, and you know, talk to me, was about the Republican Party here. This is a very prominent Republican. I've done two stories now, one that he was on a fundraising yacht with a guy who was an alleged Holocaust denier. And after writing that story last week, I found out this week, and just put up the story right before I got on with you guys, that he endorsed a local politician for a school board position. I know it's not a big deal, but this woman has been, you know, was kicked off two school district commissions for making racist and anti-Semitic remarks. She appeared at a rally with white nationalist leaders who then were going to speak at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, that famous rally where the, that woman was killed by a white supremacist. And she posted on her YouTube page a bunch of anti-Semitic videos under the title Holocaust Hoax? Suggesting that she may believe the Holocaust was a hoax. And that here's Dana Rohrabacher, a member of the United States Congress, endorsing her. And we see this with DeSantis and other people, other Republicans around the country. They keep playing footsie with these, you know, white nationalists, white supremacists, racists, anti-Semites. And, you know, my big question is, why? You know, they just can't help themselves.
They can't. And I think that's among so many other things that when added together for voters this November makes the likelihood of Republicans holding the House less realistic. And now, coupled with what's going on with the Kavanaugh hearings and other elements out there, the Senate is potentially in play as well. And McConnell, I know McConnell well, and I know sometimes he'll make these kind of comments and, you know, to sort of get people stirred up about it. But I think they're genuinely, from what I understand, are genuinely concerned about the Senate becoming a possible opportunity for Democrats to the tune of losing it by one seat. And that means a Democrat majority of one in the Senate. And that would be something that no one, except for a few of us, were talking about in January, February of this year, because those of us who spend time on the ground like you two have know that this is still a very volatile electorate. There's a lot of folks who voted for Trump in 16 are using a very different standard in 18. And Hillary's not on the ballot as much as Republicans want to try to put her there when they're not trying to lock her up. So there are a lot of factors here that are coming into play that will make the November narrative one that's going to be very foreboding for Republicans. Well, folks, I've held you guys long enough. It's great for you to come on the playground and hang out with the Man of Steel. I really appreciate it. David Korn.
Anytime, Michael.
I love it. I love it. That's David Korn. Mother Jones is Washington Bureau Chief and an on-air analyst for MSNBC. He is also the co-author with Michael Isikoff of Russian Roulette, the Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. It's a good read, folks. Not just that it flows well, but it's a lot of good stuff you probably didn't know about. David, he really put his finger, as my mama say, you put your foot in that one, boy. So we got that.
That's a compliment.
That's a good one. And Liz Copeland, she's a GOP strategist and founder of the Urban Conservative Project. Just real quick, Liz, I wanted to get a word in about that effort, the Urban Conservative Project. What are you guys doing with that? The impact you're having right now?
Oh, that's a great question. So the Urban Conservative Project is a bipartisan coalition of moderate Republicans, conservative Democrats, and independents focused on state and local issues and support of conservative policies. So we really believe that we need to move beyond the politics and really focus on the policies as it relates to tax reform, education reform, and really giving voters an opportunity to choose. Most of the urban areas have more Democrats elected to office that are, you know, supporting more liberal policies. And our goal is to work along the Northeast Corridor. We have chapters in Baltimore City, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York. And again, we support grassroots efforts for issue campaigns. We provide training and people to help get the message Excellent. Out there that, you know, we believe in, you know, a free market economy that makes sense, you know, common sense governing, and, you know, make sure that all of our individual freedoms and liberties are not trampled upon.
All right. Well, that is the Urban Conservative Project, and you just heard from the founder, Liz Copeland. A pleasure having you both on the Man of Steel podcast. And guess what, folks? For many of you out there who are married and have kids and a mortgage but don't have the life insurance because you think it costs a lot of money and you can't afford it, well, let me tell you about John. John is 35 and in pretty good shape. He got a couple of life insurance quotes, and they were outrageous. Then he called SelectQuote at 1-800-394-8967. That's 1-800-394-8967. They comparison shop highly rated term life insurance companies and give you a choice at your best rates. SelectQuote gave John the option of a $1 million policy for under $36 a month or a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. Not a bad deal. SelectQuote will get you better rates than by going directly to insurers. Call them at 1-800-394-8967. That's 1-800-394-8967 or go to SelectQuote.com. Now, get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your premium could be, you know, a little bit different, vary depending on your health and an issuing company and other factors. Not available in all states. All right, folks, that's it for me. We'll be back. You know where to find me, right here on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you like to do that podcast thing. I'm Michael Steele, host of Man of Steel Podcast. Check you out next time.